So we have a tight schedule, and again, this panel will go over the lunch hour, and I invite the audience members to, if needed, visit the many fine establishments around the Union Hall today. So my name is Linda Sheehan, and I run an organization called Earth Law Center in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I am very honored to be hosting the next panel, which is entitled Clash of Worldviews. The insights of the first panel put me to mind of a quote by Thomas Berry, a geologian and earth historian, who said that we need to ensure that our human technology is coherent with the ever-renewing technologies of the earth itself. And so we need to be inventing, reinventing human technology within the context of the community of life systems that we are a part of. And fortunately, the next panel is going to be able to help us in this quest. They'll be offering their own insights on the concept and reality of technology, to understand what technology means as it is today and how it is accelerating the spiraling degradation of Earth systems that we're seeing. They'll also help us unravel some of the hidden and not so hidden assumptions that underlie our society in general and technology in particular. And finally, and hopefully most importantly, they'll be offering us some concrete ideas about paths forward in light of this understanding about how we got here today with technology. And with that, I'm very pleased to introduce our first speaker, who is Eileen Crist. She's a professor in the Department of Science and Technology in Society at Virginia Tech. She received her PhD in sociology from BU and is co-editor of Gaia in Turmoil, Climate Change, Biodepletion, and Earth Ethics in an Age of Crisis. She's also co-editor of Keeping the Wild, Against Domestication of the Earth. She'll be speaking to us today on confronting anthropocentrism. Thank you so much and welcome, Eileen.
Hello, everyone. It's really nice to be here. Okay, I'm going to start out with a news story that I think is very fitting for this gathering. A 2013 article called RoboChop in The Economist reported a problem. Tons of jellyfish clogging the pipes of a nuclear power plant forced it to shut down. And the article also reported a solution: the deployment of a fleet of killer robots that turn jellyfish into mush. These devices follow a lead robot and work in formation. They can chop up to 900 kilograms of jellyfish an hour. Now, see, here's the question about this report. Isn't there something deeply disturbing about it? My talk is on anthropocentrism, and I'll circle back to make the connection between my topic and this report. I focus specifically on anthropocentrism, the anthropocentrism of Western culture, because this is the culture that is dominating the globe. A couple of qualifications on this point. Anthropocentrism is not necessarily a monopoly of Western culture, and there have been intellectual currents within the West that have opposed it. I will briefly touch on the questions: what is anthropocentrism? Why is it important to scrutinize? What does it do to the world and to humanity? Are we confronting it? And what possibilities open once we abandon anthropocentrism? I'm going to start with the question of why it's important to scrutinize. In facing the immense problems we've created, we encounter a notion that the overreaching power of humanity comes from our nature, from our species' essence. And there are negative and positive versions of this belief. The negative version goes something like this: well, we are greedy and selfish and aggressive by nature. Or along the same lines, the human impact is just an expression of a Darwinian process. Like any multiplying species with nothing to check our growth, we're just overexploiting our environments. The positive version of human impact is coming from our nature goes something like this: well, we are, after all, special. We're kind of godlike. But so far, we've been like reckless gods. So we need to get good at being God. And we need to use our science, our technology, and our managerial skills to put our problems behind us and then get on with our great species destiny. Now, directing the spotlight on anthropocentrism leads us away from the pitfalls of both these views about human nature. The pitfall of the negative view is just shrugging our shoulders in the face of the human impact and letting nature red in tooth and claw, just take its inevitable course. The pitfall of the positive view is the invitation to embrace the colonization of the planet and the domination of nature as humanity's manifest destiny. But anthropocentrism shifts the discussion away from human nature to the far more relevant issue of the cultural conditioning of the human. Because anthropocentrism, or human supremacy, and I use these two terms interchangeably, is the cultural conditioning into the belief that humans are superior to all other life forms and entitled to use them. In our time, human supremacy manifests as three invisible, widespread beliefs: that Earth belongs to humanity, that the planet consists in resources for the betterment of people, and that human beings are obviously superior to all other species. These beliefs are invisible in the sense that they are rarely, if ever, explicitly stated. But they can be discerned as the underlying assumptions according to which people act in the biosphere. The invisible operation of this belief system is a consequence of a long history of anthropocentrism, a history that reaches back to classical antiquity and has its roots in the birth of civilization. And we are the inheritors of this history. Our impact on nature stems from this legacy, and not from demonic flaws or godlike attributes of our nature. To look at the legacy of anthropocentrism is to look at who and what has been displaced to the periphery, and that has been wild non-humans, indigenous people, or so-called uncivilized people, and wild nature overall. The displacements can be grouped in two broad categories. They are the ideational displacements that involve belittling ideas about non-humans, about so-called savages and the wild, ideas that have enjoyed cultural preeminence. And then there are the physical displacements that have to do with geographical conquests that have exterminated and dislocated others. The ideational displacements are tied to a leading motif in Western thought: to contemplate the phenomenon of the human by posing the question, how are humans different from other species? Different, capital D. John Rodman summarized this key question as the differential imperative, described as the proclivity for isolating the distinguishing characteristics of humans from all other life forms. There has been no shortage of proposed distinguishing attributes. Reason, language, morality, civilization, technology, free will, etc. These have been offered and offered again and again as human distinctions. And such distinctions have been foundational for hierarchical narratives about life. Probably the most enduring of these stories, threading through very different traditions of thought, has been the great chain of being, with man at the top, minerals at the bottom, and we all know how to fill the space between. This hierarchical order has not only been about the nature of being, what philosophers call ontology, but it has also been a moral order, sanctioning man's use of everything beneath him. The physical displacements we are keenly familiar with. Before the civilized conqueror, forests have given way, and so have grasslands and wetlands, and rivers and lakes, and more recently the seas. Wild animals have been killed, enslaved, forced to remote areas, and driven to regional or total extinctions. Indigenous people have been labeled as savages or as animals and endured genocides and subjugations. Now, the ideational displacements, these cognitive belittlements of others, and the physical displacements have worked closely together. Anthropocentrism is not just a worldview. It's not just a picture of how things are. It is a lived worldview, a perspective that has carved the very world we inhabit, both mentally and physically. For a snapshot of what that worldview is capable of, we might think of the 19th century takeover of the American plains. Neither supremacist ideas nor technological power, guns and plows, alone can explain the brutality with which the buffalo, the plains people, and the grasslands were treated. But the alliance between the superiority complex and the technical prowess of the civilized conqueror, this lived worldview of human supremacy, sheds light on so many crimes committed against the living world. Okay, so I've talked about the displacements of anthropocentrism, and now I want to go to the question of what does it do to human beings who come under its spell? And I'm going to touch on two consequences for humanity. One, the inability to discern any reason for limiting expansionism. And two, becoming blindsided to the loss of the planet's richness and beauty. On the first point, the wisdom of limitations belongs to cultures that respect their non-human and human neighbors. It is that respect that gives rise to restraint. But the worldview of human supremacy, in that worldview, respect for neighbors and their homes is extinguished by disparaging beliefs. Either they do not morally count, or they are inferior, or they are nothing but resources. So the conditioning of the human into a culture that is superior and entitled precludes the arising of restraint that comes from respect, from caring, and from a desire to fit in rather than take over. So nonstop expansionism is effectively built into human supremacy. Today, this absence of limitations, of restraint, is rampant all around us. It has become a kind of madness. We see it in the normalized violence of factory farms, the trashing and depletion of the seas, the drive to dam the rivers of the world, the rendition of whole landscapes in pursuit of fossil fuels, the trading of rainforests for plantations and pasture. We see the inability to countenance restraint even in the defiance of the number 350 parts per million. Civilization seems unable to halt its expansionism even in the face of its own potential demise. So beyond the inability to discern any reason for limitation, humanity has also blindsided itself to the loss of so much of the natural world. And here a sentence from the writing of Horkheimer and Adorno speaks to this point. They write, "Men pay for the increase in power with alienation from that over which they exercise power." And how true this statement is about human relationships, and not least about the relationship between humanity and nature. A phenomenon broadly indicative of this alienation is the shifting ecological baseline. With each generation, ecological impoverishment increases, but each generation takes that impoverished condition as normal. Since wild beings have not been neighbors, neither their presence nor their disappearance has, for the most part, warranted recording. Amnesia about the living world is the existential condition that we have reaped in exchange for the supremacist exercise of power. Another pinnacle of alienation from the biosphere today is the ongoing invisibility of the mass extinction episode underway. Mass extinction remains publicly largely unknown, little understood, and rarely talked about. Okay, so I've touched on what human supremacy does to civilized humanity, disabling limitations and blinding people to the loss of life. Even so, today there is something new happening, a dawning recognition of the mounting and dangerous side effects of expanding civilization. So there's a sense of big trouble coming our way. What is the prevalent response? Has it been to confront the historical legacy of human supremacy, its displacements, extinctions, lack of restraint, alienation from the living world, and ecological amnesia? Not to date. No mainstream politician, media, or NGO has confronted the anthropocentric worldview. Instead, the prevailing response to ecological challenges has been a riff on the human supremacist storyline. We are the resourceful race. We're the technological magicians, the god species. These are the kind of exhortations we hear nowadays. So in this vein, the standard approach to solving problems is piecemeal and technological. And I'll give you a couple of high-profile examples of that. Shortages of fresh water will be tackled with desalinization or by redirecting entire rivers. Diminishing fossil fuels will be countered with extreme technologies that extract from deep sediments, from mountaintops, and from deforested landscapes. Down the road, algae or switchgrass or some kind of biomass will be repurposed for fuel. If climate disruption gets out of hand, well, maybe geoengineering will save the day. Adequate food, that will be secured by genetically engineering crops and animals. If wild fish become depleted, well, we can just escalate our fish factories. And to circle back to the beginning, when jellyfish clog up our pipes, well, we'll just invent high-tech robots and cut them into bits. Never mind that the jellyfish blooms everywhere in the oceans are a consequence of what we have been doing to the oceans. So when we consider all these approaches as a whole, and we think of them as examples of a single framework, we can apprehend that the framework keeps the spotlight on human ingenuity to solve the problems, and it even invites admiration for that ingenuity. Most importantly, the piecemeal technological framework avoids challenging human expansionism, but on the contrary, it wants to make human dominion sustainable. Namely, that the Earth belongs to humanity, that the planet consists in resources, and that humans are obviously superior and entitled vis-a-vis all other species. So here I will close by raising but not answering the question, what possibilities open if we choose to abandon anthropocentrism and create a new worldview and a new civilization? Namely, that Earth is a community of unique beings, places, and cultures. That the planet, inhabited with restraint, is abundant for our material sustenance and ravishing for our spirit. And that the natural world abounds in diverse forms of intelligence and awareness. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I'd like to introduce next Tom Butler, who is the Editorial Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology, and he's also the president of the New England Wilderness Trust. He's the author of Wildlands Philanthropy and co-editor of Energy, Overdevelopment, and the Delusion of Endless Growth, Plundering Appalachia, The Tragedy of Mountaintop Removal Mining and Coal Mining, and Keeping the Wild Against the Domestication of the Earth. Tom will be talking today about how our language reinforces the worldview of dominion over the earth, such as we were starting to hear about with Eileen's talk just now. So thank you very much, and welcome, Tom.
The diminishing returns of technology, apparently. Amazing, amazing. I guess I'm going to have to live with that. I feel a little hesitant to be even mildly critical of my hero, Jerry Mander, but I think he's left the hall, so I can be curmudgeonly. Oh, dear. Well, I confess to being a little bit skeptical about techno-utopianism and the fate of the Earth. That's a mouthful. That's techno-utopianism gets you 8 syllables even before you get to the fate of the Earth. And it seemed to me like a brilliant ad guy like Jerry might have come up with something a little punchier, a little more pithy, maybe even an acronym, one syllable, maybe in the form of a man's name, something like Ted. That one's taken, I guess, but, you know, given we heard Richard Heinberg's talk and in anticipation of John Michael Greer's, we'd probably want to be sort of vaguely apocalyptic. So I propose, humbly, that maybe this event should have been the Fred Talks. No, you haven't even heard. You haven't even heard the acronym, and that stands for Facing the Reality of Extinction and Doom. This would be apocalyptic ideas worth dreading. We didn't plan it, but apparently my talk actually is Eileen Crist's talk, but knowing that I would need help, I would need pretty pictures, mine's in the form of an illustrated bedtime story for adults. And like any grand narrative that is either portentous or even, you know, pretentious, it begins with those great three words, in the beginning. In the beginning, the world was whole and beauty prevailed. Life begetting life until the waters, then the lands were filled with creatures. Myriad were their languages, from the vaguely imperceptible song of moss to the bugling of elk. Whales performed their symphonies in the deep. The sounds of life were everywhere. Life pulsed and contracted and flourished through the ages. After innumerable epochs had passed, a creature appeared who learned to speak and count. For millennia, he lived well among his wild kin. But as his cleverness grew, so did his ambitions, until the day he declared himself ruler of all. Believing the self-deception that his kind was sovereign over the others, he taught his children that the earth had been made for man's use and profit. He no longer recognized his neighbors in the community of life, instead calling them natural resources. His work he named Progress. The old religions, which had long tied the human tribe to the other creatures in a circle of reciprocity, were forgotten. Feigning himself Lord Man, he grew ever more clever. He learned to gather and burn fossil fuels made by ancient geological forces. Praise was sung incessantly to the new god, Growth. His numbers became multitudes. As the multitudes spread across the face of the earth, the songs of the other creatures grew fewer and fainter. Many voices went permanently quiet, replaced by the sounds of machines digging, churning, scarring the land, and driving the whales crazy with the noise. Every day, the earth grew poorer, transformed bit by bit by Lord Man's numbers and actions. The seas were emptied of fish and filled with garbage. The trees were replaced by bleeding stumps. The prairies were transformed into feeding factories for the ever-expanding human masses. Smokestacks darkened the skies. No place was sacred. No landscape safe from the insatiable creature's thirst for more energy to serve his god of growth. Lord Man tamed rivers, split atoms, decapitated mountains, and stabbed the earth everywhere he thought a vein of fuel lay hidden. When the feverish earth cried out, sending furies to communicate her distress, Lord Man denied her sickness until it no longer could be denied. Slowly, the scales began to fall from his eyes when he saw famine ravage the land, when he saw precious sources of fresh water disappear, when the longing that gnawed on his spirit made him recall so many creatures that had passed into oblivion. Seeing the effects of his hubris, he began to wonder if his empire was secure. His delusion weakened just enough to reveal the choice before him. Two paths. One, leading to an abundant earth filled with birdsong. The other, the way of growth, offered riches for some, misery for many, and ultimate destruction for all his tribe. Would he restrain his numbers and rejoin the community of life as plain member and citizen? Or attempt to engineer all the earth to his will, heeding only the call of more? The call of more. So that's my shorthand of how we got to this moment into the so-called Thank you. That's my parable for how we got to this moment, into the so-called Anthropocene, the age of human dominion. And now we're enveloped in the technosphere, this world of human-created artifacts and techniques, a hyper-complex interconnected system of exploitative processes running on this one-time windfall of cheap fossil energy. But as normal as this may seem to us in a place like this, in a grand city like this, in this particular moment, it is, of course, a very, very new phenomenon in human history. For the vast, vast majority of our history as a species, humans were embedded not in the technosphere, but in the biosphere, embedded in the fabric of life that conceived us. We had emerged from this boundless creativity of wild nature that also birthed the trilobites, and then later the dinosaurs, and then much later other large mammals like us, the grizzlies and the gorillas. And if this is our deepest human experience, if this is our fundamental history, to be members of the biotic community, and not self-appointed overseers of the planetary plantation, then how do we go so wrong? Now, that is beyond the scope of our time here to dig into too deeply, into the causes of humanity's break from nature. But it's really fun around the campfire conversation, a conversation I actually had around a campfire in the last week with some of the folks in the hall today, to think about how we got to this place. What were those root drivers? Was it the invention of capitalism, or was it really the invention of agriculture that got us on the wrong path? Or going way back, was it the invention of language that allowed early humans to hunt cooperatively, to begin to kill other large mammals and have that break from primal unity? That's fun to think about. I really like to have that conversation around the campfire, but it's beyond our scope to delve into today. What we can say is that language, which we should note is also a very recent invention, relatively recent invention in human history, language is powerful. Language powerfully shapes the way we see the world. Language is the foundation of this industrial worldview that we're discussing this weekend, that worldview that seeks to commodify every part of nature's richness and bounty, to bend the earth to our will, to garden it for our purposes. The lexicon of techno-industrial growth culture supports that process of assimilation. Now, it's common sense, of course, to understand that our linguistic patterns shape our cognitive frames. And there are genuine bona fide scholars on this panel and others to come who are better suited to dissect this. But as a simple-minded sort, as a non-academic, a simple lover of wilderness and wildlife, that is, wilderness, self-willed lands, not bent or yoked to human will, and self-willed creatures who call those places home, and as a practicing on-the-ground conservationist with the Northeast Wilderness Trust, I can tell you, it drives me nuts. It drives me crazy to hear how so many colleagues and friends in our own community in the conservation and environmental movements have so unthinkingly adopted the language of resourcism, of possession of the earth. Now, we expect to hear the language of dominion from the enemies of nature, from the PR flacks of the corporations, from the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, from the ad agencies who are the hired guns for every destructive form of technology. It's no surprise when the manufacturer of an all-terrain vehicle tells us, don't just hit the trail, pound it mercilessly. And that's real ad copy, which, not incidentally, is actually really quite good. It's a very pithy ad copy. It's morally repugnant, but it's good. But that doesn't bother me so much as it does to hear how our own community speaks of humanity's relationship to the earth. So how about this ad from the Nature Conservancy recently in Time magazine, right there by the pharmaceutical ads, which helpfully informs us that nature cleans our air. Well, isn't that really nice of Mother Nature, you know, here framed for us as a sort of planetary cleaning lady, cleaning up after those messy humans, tidying up our air. Our air, note that possessive. You know that air belongs to us, of course. And this is just one of a series of ads that the Nature Conservancy has been running to communicate the so-called array of ecosystem services that nature provides to humanity. Now, it's true, certainly, that humanity depends utterly upon nature's diversity and ecological functioning. Promoting conservation as primarily not about preventing extinction, human-caused extinction, but primarily about sustaining ecosystem services is this fundamentally anthropocentric frame. It's implicit in those in the term even. It's those ecosystems out there serve us. Or consider this example here, of the kind of language that everyone in the hall would have seen from either an environmental group or a greenwashing corporation. Our environment's precious. Good stewardship of natural resources is key to sustaining a healthy working landscape. So let's unpack this one a bit. Okay, there we have the possessive again. You know, the world is ours. It's not the community of life to which we belong, but it's the backdrop to human history. It's just the stuff around us, an environment. But even used as that sort of shorthand moniker for the totality of organic and inorganic elements of the ecosphere, the environment, like the economy, is an abstraction. It helps distance us from reality, from caring about real places, real forests or wetlands or grasslands, the home to real creatures that are being destroyed by the expanding technosphere. The environment, of course, in this kind of framing is just a collection of what? Of natural resources that we are free to exploit, perhaps gently, if we want to use good stewardship. So the phrase natural resources, or natural resources, of course, commodifies the living earth, again, in an anthropocentric framing. And as for stewardship, which is a perfectly awful word, look up the etymology. Look it up. The steward comes from the sty ward, the ward of the sty, the ward of the hogs out behind the thatch-covered hovel. So stewardship, whether practiced either kindly or rapaciously, means domestication and management. And domestication also is implicit and framed positively in this working landscape phrase, which, of course, trickled down from industrial forest clear-cutters who started celebrating the so-called working forest and now is widely used by people who should know better and who think of themselves as environmentalists. So to confront anthropocentrism, this worldview of supposed human exceptionalism that makes humanity's thoughtless appropriation or even enslavement of the world seem perfectly natural and normal to us, we must confront also the language of dominion, and that begins at home with all of us. So I would challenge you to keep a watchful eye out for these and other pernicious terms that support a resourcist relationship to the earth and which convey that managerial mindset. And once you start looking for them, I guarantee you will see them everywhere. Look for them, highlight them, note them, and renounce them. Renounce them. Let all of us who imagine a future world of beauty and diversity begin to use a rhetoric of reciprocity, the language of love, when speaking of the wild earth, not an environment, not a garden to be managed, but a wild community of life, a living membership, our one and only home. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Next, we'll be hearing from Lisi Krall, who's a professor of economics at the State University of New York, Cortland, where she focuses on labor, political economy, and ecology. She's also a board member of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. She received her PhD in economics from the University of Utah and is the author of Proving Up, Domesticating Land in U.S. History. She's published in the Cambridge Journal of Economics, in the Journal of Economic Issues, and in Ecological Economics. She'll be speaking to us today about the nature of the economic structure within which we live and the history of how we got here, which will provide the foundation for important lessons about how do we move forward.
There's probably only one thing worse than an economist, and that's an economist who snoops around where they shouldn't. That would be me. This might be a case of a little bit of knowledge being dangerous. I actually struggled with whether I should give this particular presentation today because I knew it would be actually be difficult to explore this topic in depth in the time that I had, and that would make for the possibility of misreading between the lines. In the end, I decided to go ahead with it because my goal is to nudge you to think in a slightly different way about our anthropocentrism and about the problematic relationship we now have with the earth. Let me just add that what I say here is based on work that I've done with a colleague, John Gowdy, and it's interdisciplinary work that involves evolutionary biology, anthropology, and economics. Clearly, our relationship to technology must be understood in sufficient depth that we don't end up believing that saving the earth is simply a matter of choosing the right technology. If only it were that simple. The fate and integrity of earth and our ability to reconcile our species with it is not a simple technological matter. It is a matter of once again becoming a species in context, to use the wonderful words of Wes Jackson. And that, of course, is more challenging. If we want to accomplish that, we are required to get under the skin of our economic order and down to its bone and sinew, because the architecture of our dominion and the architecture of our anthropocentrism lie here. In that spirit, I want to explore with you what I call the economic evolution of dominion. And what I ask from you in this exercise is to keep an open mind in the face of somewhat iconoclastic propositions. If we use a very broad stroke, we can roughly divide our economic evolution into three periods. The first is the Pleistocene, where we took on our present genome, reproduced our material life mostly as hunters and gatherers, did not dominate the ecosystems we inhabited. Instead, we were mostly embedded in them and governed by their rhythm and cycles. And we were not structurally expansionary. And although we were interconnected in productive activity, tremendous interdependence around material life was not the order of the day, particularly with food production, in that each individual had a certain capacity to fend for themselves. The division of labor that existed was based primarily on age and gender. The second period is the Holocene, which offered sufficient climatic stability for the Neolithic Revolution. It is here we began to dominate and alter the ecosystems within which we resided. With agriculture, we weren't merely harvesting the bounties of nature, we were managing and altering the potentiality of nature and directing it toward our species. We became interdependent with an extensive division of labor around a managed and essentially internalized system of food production. Expansion was endemic to this system, and our relationship to the earth imperialistic. And as individuals, we became much less independent in the provisioning of material life, in particular food, and much more interdependent around what essentially was a self-referential system. We became a species out of context with agriculture, indeed an ultra-social species. I realize this is somewhat counterintuitive, because there's a somewhat romantic belief that agriculture can make us self-sufficient and reconnect us to the natural world. If it's done right, maybe it can. But try, if you will, to appreciate that in the context of our social and economic evolution, agriculture, especially around the growing of annual grains, reconfigured us as a species in a revolutionary way. We were altered as a social species, so much so that I believe in the evolutionary matrix, the agricultural group had sufficient cohesion and integrity that it essentially became a unit of selection. The third period is what some called the Anthropocene, where the marriage of the Industrial Revolution and capitalism put the interdependent, self-referential, expansionary, and imperialistic path that began with agriculture in overdrive, ultimately bringing our dominion here to global monopoly finance capital and the sixth great mass extinction. Now, what I'm saying is that in an economic sense, in the sense of the evolution of our species, the Anthropocene began with agriculture, not the Industrial Revolution. The importance of the Neolithic Revolution has been eclipsed by our emphasis and preoccupation with the Industrial Revolution and capitalism, but I think there is something to be gained by recognizing and understanding that agriculture was the decisive and critical turning point. I like to say that we are genetically of the Pleistocene, but in terms of the most profound manifestation of our social evolution, the configuration of economic and productive life, we are a product of the Holocene and the Neolithic Revolution. Our present economic system has great fidelity to the economic structure and dynamic put in play with agriculture. It is derivative of it. For humans, agriculture arose independently in different parts of the world and around different annual grains, but the outcome was the same. Within 5,000 years of the onset of agriculture, large-scale state societies had evolved along with ecological disaster and an interdependence that had taken a decidedly hierarchical form. Estimates are that human population increased from around 6 million people when the agricultural revolution took hold to 200 million people 8,000 years later, and many of these lived essentially in slavery. Populations that practiced agriculture appeared to have had a selective advantage over those that didn't, if numbers are any indication. And these societies became finely articulated in form and function, taking on a mechanistic appearance. Lewis Mumford comments on the change that took place in reference to the large-scale societies that developed in Sumer and Egypt after the agricultural revolution. He tells us there was, and these are his words, an invisible machine that anticipated the machine itself. There was a mechanical order to society, indeed a centralized intelligence. Now, I want to point out something else. We weren't the only species to practice agriculture. Many ant and termite species also practice agriculture, and they do not have the individual intelligence that we do. So any idea that our agricultural revolution was brought about by our unique ingenuity might be rethought. For example, the amazing Atta ants harvest leaves that they then use to cultivate fungi, which they eat. Insect agriculturalists are not the Holocene species we are. They made their transition much earlier, some as much as 50 million years ago, and they cultivate cultivate fungi, not primarily annual grains. But this is the thing. Despite these differences, they end up with an economic structure and dynamic that is remarkably similar to that of humans when humans made the transition to agriculture. They are similarly expansionary. They are profoundly interdependent with an extensive division of labor. They dominate the ecosystems in which they occur. And trust me, they have their own civilizations. Vast, finely articulated colonies with great architectural integrity. Some species of ants become extremely specialized in their roles. They exhibit phenotypic variation depending on the task that they do. You get, you know, tiny ants that ride on top of larger leaf carriers that their sole purpose is to defend them from attacks by parasitic flies. You have untouchables who remove waste from the colonies. And again, like humans, they are very successful species if success is measured by numbers. E.O. Wilson labels the success of social insects the social conquest of the earth. I don't believe these similarities are coincidental. They're a matter of convergent evolution. In simplistic terms, agriculture presents a species with an opportunity to access more energy, but it must have the ability to configure itself to take advantage of that opportunity. That is to say, it must have the capacity to implement a division of labor sufficient to agriculture, because agriculture demands a more elaborate division of labor. The mechanisms by which species reconfigure themselves might be different and are different, but that might be less important in the unfolding evolutionary dynamic than we've been led to believe. Ants use chemical cues and phenotypic variation, and humans rely more on culture and institutions. But the results are similar. They were able to reconfigure themselves productively to take advantage of the opportunity that agriculture presented. And in the end, you have very different species that end up socially and productively reconfigured in the same way. Our genome was altered very little with agriculture, but our social and productive configuration was profoundly altered. Now, you might ask, why do we care about this similarity between these diverse species? You might even be saying, this woman is crazy. What the heck is she talking about? But my answer is this. This exercise should inform us that our dominion over the earth is a complex evolutionary matter, not a matter of human exceptionalism. And our evolution as a species is not simply a matter of our genome. It is a matter of our social evolution, which is to say, the productive configuration of our species. The forces of natural selection play on this as well. Dominion is embedded in the configuration of economic life, and so we should pay attention to this configuration because it is at the heart of both our anthropocentrism and, dare I say, anthropocentrism. This dynamic and structure put in motion with agriculture is especially problematic for humans, who, unlike ants, are large, who have recourse to exosomatic extensions of themselves, who have culture and institutional fabric, all of which reinforce and expedite the structure and dynamic at play. These are powerful forces in our evolutionary matrix, which have made our dominion and the path of our social, that is, economic evolution, all the more pernicious and problematic. In the end, market society evolves out of agricultural society. Market society, especially when fertilized with fossil fuel, engenders an extreme rendering of dominion over the earth that began with agriculture, and it has great fidelity to the revolution that preceded it. Globalized monopoly finance capital is a self-referential system par excellence. Profound interdependence and an expansionary dynamic that is in its systems dynamic actually somewhat disconnected from the Earth. Our peculiar and problematic evolutionary history has brought us to this tragic moment. Tragic for the Earth and its many species, and tragic for us. One could easily argue that our social and economic evolution has taken us in a direction at odds with our Pleistocene genome, which is most comfortable and healthy when we are embedded in a non-human world. We are rapidly and exponentially approaching a point of no return. It is clear we will not avert this tragic conclusion with technology and human ingenuity. Instead, we have to reckon our social, economic evolution with our Pleistocene genome, which means we have to end the dominion over the Earth that is embedded in the very structure and dynamic of our economic order. Thank you.
Next, I'd like to welcome Susan Griffin. Susan is a poet, essayist, playwright, and screenwriter. She's the author of over 20 books, including Women in Nature, which inspired the eco-feminist movement. Her book on nuclear weapons, A Chorus of Stones, The Private Life of War, was a New York Times notable book and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Susan was named by Utney Reader as one of 100 visionaries for the new millennium. She's currently writing a book called Sustainability and the Soul, and her remarks today will reflect that work. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
Sorry for this hat, but I have to keep the light out of my eyes. I contemplate a tree. I can assign it to a species and observe it as an instance. I can dissolve it into a number. But it can also happen, if will and grace are joined, that as I contemplate the tree, I am drawn into a relation, and the tree ceases to be an it. Those are the words that Martin Buber wrote in 1923 in his classic, I, Thou. Along with Eileen and Tom and Lisa, you know, I think what we're stating here today is that what we have in our society today is an I-it, not an I-thou relationship with nature. And that I-it, by the way, relationship extends to various groups within our culture, the way we view indigenous peoples, the way we view women, the way we view people of color, is also tends to be more objectifying and closer to an it than a thou. But at the same time, you know, more science is discovering intelligence in the universe and in nature every day. I learn about something, it seems that I learn about something new, some way that plants have intelligence, extraordinary, you know, the abstract thinking of slime mold. Have you heard about that? It's quite amazing. They can solve these incredible labyrinthine problems. But we still are hanging on to this experiential attitude. We may have a cognitive recognition of intelligence and or soul or an inner life in nature, but we hang on to this idea of the universe as essentially dead. And that creates some problems for us. Of course, it leads to global warming, it leads to economic inequities, but there's also another problem which is essentially psychological. And this psychological problem reinforces the economic and social attitudes that we have that are exploiting the Earth. We can't have a meaningful relationship anymore with many of us with nature. And that's because it's very difficult to maintain or to even initiate a stimulating relationship with a corpse. So we've got some solutions, though. A solution like the steam train, which really inaugurated, in many ways, the Industrial Revolution. The steam train had another purpose, And that was, it functioned as a kind of mechanical Viagra, for both sexes, of course. It brought excitement back into life. Now, of course, the steam train promised a kind of utopia, as every new invention does. So Mark Seekun, for instance, who was inventor of the wide cable suspension bridge, and who laid a steam train, who developed a steam train in Lyon in the 19th century, wrote that the enjoyment, the commodities of life, which had been reserved for only men of fortune, will be shared by all classes. Now, in fact, we know that that's not at all what happened with the Industrial Revolution, nor with the steam train, that the Industrial Revolution led to terrible economic inequality as people took the train into the cities. There was a surplus of labor, and in addition to that, children were exploited in labor. But clearly, at the same time, the steam trade had something really thrilling to offer, and Seekun talks about that. Long ribbons of iron along which rush, rapid as thought, those fordable machines which seem to eat up space with a spontaneous impatience and which seem almost alive in their breathing and their movement. So you can see the erotic nature of this this great love of steam trains. Now, where's that little thing? I don't know how to operate this. Oh, there it is, there it is. Okay, but so here's the incredible thing. The formidable erotic powers of the steam train seem to restore the life force that our worldview had stolen from nature, even while it was instrumental in destroying nature. Does anybody know what this is here?
Detroit Village.
Bison skulls. So what would happen is on the steam trains that went west, one of the attractions of that rail trip to the west was that the train would stop in certain places where buffalo herds roamed, and the men on the train could get off and they could shoot. And so, you know, the buffalo almost became extinct. In the early part of the 19th century, speed itself became the object of adulation. It was worshipped by many, including especially the Italian writer and founder of a movement called Futurism, F.T. Marinetti. And I'm going to read you a few words from an essay he wrote called The New Religion, Morality of Speed. The futurist morality will protect man against the inevitable decay produced by slowness, memory, analysis, rest, and habit. Human energy, multiplied by 100-fold by velocity, will dominate space and time. Velocity has given human life one of the attributes of divinity, the straight line. Velocity is naturally pure, slowness is naturally unclean. After destroying traditional good and evil, we are creating a new good, speed, and a new evil, slowness. We intend to glorify war. This is from another piece that he wrote called The Futurist Manifesto. He wrote, "We intend to glorify war, the only hygiene of the world, militarism, patriotism, beautiful ideas worth dying for, and contempt for women." You see, the way that all of these things fit together. Marinetti became—he was the head of what was the Futurist political party, which merged in Italy with the Fascist party, and he became a staunch supporter of Mussolini, leading to this. If I can get this to go forward, I mean, they said this is very simple, but not for me. Okay. This, do I do that? Oh, there it is. Oh, great. So, doesn't that look like those bison skulls? You know, that's Florence after a bombardment in World War II. So, you know, seeing nature is dead, then we create our own deaths. But instead of questioning our worldview at any point, we simply accelerate our efforts to awaken ourselves, to awaken, to re-stimulate ourselves. So we've come up with a new kind of Viagra, and that is electronic Viagra. So I thought of this when I saw an ad for some sort of, I don't know what it was, for some sort of software, something to do with computers. And it was a, something that was a faster connection. It probably had to do with the internet, and it was faster, because speed is the most important element that is advertised for anything in the world of computers right now. So shows a guy, and he's getting this really fast connection, and he declares, "I never felt more alive." But actually, what a computer is it's a simulacrum of life, and it's dead. It's a dead simulacrum of life, what you're seeing on the screen. I could discuss at length here. I don't have the time, but I'd love at some point in our discussions afterwards to talk about the difference between that sort of simulacrum and art, which also copies life, but with a different end, in a different way. So once again, the claim was made with computers is that it's going to equalize everything. It's going to put us all on an equal footing, especially politically. We're going to be able to get the word out, and to some extent we can do that. But what the computer, with its speed, is best at is accumulating big data. And big data is very good for accumulating big wealth. So that's its main function in the business world. And I want to quote to you from Emma Uprichard, who, from the University of Warwick. She's a professor of sociology. And this is what she has to say about big data. It's being presented as the future problem solver for all things from breast cancer to low-cost governance, from better security to predictive systems, from smart cities and better traffic and water systems to an end to urban squalor. It promises cleaner, more sustainable, renewable energy, better banking, better governance, better education for all, more efficient, faster, more cost-effective everything. If we thought utopian authors were full of hope for better futures, the public discourse of big data is akin to a future fairy godmother with a magic wand granting wishes to help solve some of the world's most wicked problems. So, of course, you know, I'm not arguing here against the collection of data at all. I love the data about the 99%, for instance, versus the 1%. There's some very important data that is also being, young people are being studied, and it's found, for instance, that in the United States, young people tend to be 75 times more violent than young people in other nations. So this kind of data is useful. But numbers are stripped of the earth. They're stripped of place. I mean, the numbers, the big data, the computers have realized Marinetti's dream. They're stripped of place, time. They're stripped of also of stories, breakfast, lunch, dinner, smiles, tears, empathy, emotional intelligence, not to speak of, in fact, the real erotic mysteries that come to us from sunrise, sunset, the night sky, flight of birds, migrating south for the summer, or the eyes of somebody we love. Numbers don't have any of that. That's their virtue. They're supposedly objective, and therefore they're placed, by the way, above human responses and above us. For instance, you know, I hate public polls, and I hate polls of all kinds and questionnaires. For instance, if I'm asked, you know, have you ever been arrested, I would have to say yes, I was arrested. And then that would place me closer on a scale to a psychopath because I've been arrested. That's part of the data that makes you a psychopath. However, it doesn't ask me what I was arrested for or why I was arrested. I was arrested once protesting apartheid, once protesting the buildup to the war in Iraq, and another time because I refused to move when I was witnessing incidents of police brutality. So data is being used a great deal now in medicine, and my neighbor, who's a wonderful doctor and a very humane one, has told me that what he's observed in the medical profession is the doctors are no longer palpating their patients. Right, you know, Helen knows that. They're just relying on the data, on the lab results, which are subject to error. There's this other idea that somehow the data is never wrong, but it's often wrong because the data comes from ultimately a subjective viewpoint. This idea that an objective viewpoint is possible is not even possible in science, much less in social science. What we're doing is we're completing a sort of ultimate feedback cycle. Another way to think about it is that it's a very elaborate Ponzi scheme. We're promised that we're going to get rich, but actually it's impoverishing us all. Not only is it impoverishing the environment, but we're starting to impoverish ourselves. When we impoverish our idea of the body and the way we heal and approach the body, that's a very serious lessening of ourselves, of our being. But what we're also impoverishing right now is consciousness. Ironically, the epistemology, we start with an epistemology saying, you know, there's an I and an it. And the I is supposed to be ensouled and have intelligence and empathy, and the it is an object. Now we're making consciousness itself into an it, and I'm just going to talk about two of those fields. One is what Cornel West is calling, instead of education, market-driven schooling. This is what market-driven schooling. I love that quote from him. From as young as 5 years of age, and I know this because I saw it in my grandchildren who are going to a very good educational system in Berkeley, but still have to be subject to this because of the federal laws. Children are tested day in and day out. They spend whole days being tested, and it goes on for probably about a third of the time that they're in school. And then what happens is that the amount of money that a public school gets is based on these test scores. And if they're low, this is paradoxical, it doesn't make any sense. The school gets less money. It really ought to be when the school gets more money if the tests are low. But what happens is these kids are being trained not in thinking, not in creative thinking, not in critical thinking. They're being trained in passing tests, which means they're being trained to resemble the binary system that determines computers, so that they're being trained in yes or no, or multiple choice polls. Their brains are being shaped in this way. The other thing that we're doing, by the way, these very test scores have indicated that poetry, music, art are no longer very important in our school curriculum because they're not what drives the GNP, and it's not what prepares students to be employed in the new economy. Is somebody as intelligent as who is the mayor of San Francisco who's become part of the state of? Yes, Gavin Newsom gave a speech about how education is going to be completely different. Now it's very practical. We're getting everybody to be able to go right into the workplace. The same thing is happening in psychology. A student cannot get a doctorate or a PsyD degree any longer without doing quantitative studies. They have to learn statistics. More and more, psychology is being driven by big data. And that is hooked to the pharmaceutical companies. And the pharmaceutical companies make a lot of money, which they funnel into the American Psychological Association, which determines what the standards are for somebody getting a degree in the profession of being a psychologist. By the way, I want to quote to you from... what do I have, 2 minutes now? Great, thanks. Okay, I want to quote to you from an article by two Native American psychologists, Virgil Moorhead and Joseph Gunn, in an article that hasn't been published yet, but will be, several, they were doing a study, it had to be a quantitative study, but what they point out within that study, sort of a subversive tactic, is that several participants felt that positivistic, materialistic, quantitative data can be a barrier to implementing culturally sensitive interventions to those indigenous communities. In other words, using traditional, this quantitative data is a barrier to using traditional healing practices. I'm going to end with a quote because there are many cultures that still do carry an understanding of nature is thou and live by that. And I'm going to quote you from a poem by the Senegalese poet. I'm going to end with these words. From the Senegalese poet Tiro Seydou Sall. Having become choreographers, the stars orchestrate in their white robes, tapestries of dreams, pain and joy, pulsations of love in the heart of life. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. And our final panelist today will be Charlene Spretnak. She is the co-founder of the U.S. Green Party and the author of Green Politics, The Resurgence of the Real, Relational Reality, and many eco-social essays. She was named by the British government as one of the 100 eco-heroes of all time. And her newest book, The Spiritual Dynamic in Modern Art, was just published this week. Charlene will be speaking today on the importance of understanding organic, dynamic interrelatedness in assessing technology. Welcome, Charlene.
I'm going to come at this subject from a somewhat different direction, building on these astute critiques my fellow panelists have given about essentially a lot of examples they stated from what is the mechanistic worldview. And that, of course, has shaped our systems of knowledge. It shaped the way we were all socialized and the way we relate to technology. So the mechanistic worldview holds that every person and every entity is essentially separate and discrete. And entities, whether they're people or marsupials or poplar trees, they can be in some kind of relationship or not, but that certainly doesn't affect their internal constitution and the way they function physically. So that's the mechanistic perspective. But there's also a relational perspective, which acknowledges that every entity exists in a field of dynamic interrelationships. And they definitely do affect how your internal organ systems work and how you function in the world. And the interrelationships are dynamic, meaning they're always in flux, they respond to minute changes, they're creative, unpredictable, and full of possibilities. Now, even in the 19th century, there were some people who saw there are some real problems with the assumptions and premises of the mechanistic worldview. And really, there's been this attempted correction of it going on, at least since 1905 with Einstein's two papers, which established a relational perspective on matter and energy. But it's turned out that the mechanistic worldview has been very difficult to dislodge. And you may remember that there were a number of best-selling books in the last quarter of the 20th century, and these were all about the implications of relational discoveries in quantum physics, and then chaos theory, and then complexity studies. And these books asserted that soon this relational thinking from these discoveries would ripple out and transform all our institutions. Right, we can look around and see that our institutions were not transformed. And I think that's probably because the nature of those discoveries was too abstract for most people to pay a lot of attention to. So, there was one partial success story, of course, from that period, which started out being called alternative medicine and then complementary medicine, integral medicine, which was eventually given a small, grudgingly given a small and very incongruous place in the mainstream medical system. But the millennial turning came and went, and I was still waiting to see the big correction, the grand correction to the mechanistic worldview. And I have to admit, I really got to a point where I thought, I may not see this. It may not happen in my lifetime. Okay, but then around 2004, I opened the newspaper one morning and I saw a small article, and it was on a discovery about the human body. And the researchers said they were very surprised by the findings. So I read that article, and I was very surprised by the findings. And then a few weeks later, I saw a similar one, and then I saw more in the months and years that followed. So I started saving all these because I saw that what these new discoveries had in common was that they were challenging the prevailing view of the human organism as essentially a biomachine, a very complicated biomachine. And these discoveries were actually revealing, they were surprising because they were revealing the extent to which the human organism actually is structured by and functions through dynamic interrelationships. So I had bulging files of this eventually, and I drew them all together and presented them in this book, Relational Reality, a couple of years ago. But they kept on coming, so I have another bulging file, and you'll see them now because you'll be able to recognize, oh, I see, that's another one that is showing these relational results that go against the mechanistic assumptions. So I'm going to give you just a few examples. One of them was they did a study a few years ago of 906 elderly adults, and they found that the ones that had few friendships or other social interactions had a rapid decline in motor function, standing, gripping, balancing. And then there was a study 2 years ago, 2012, this is about children, the development of children, and they found that children who between ages 5 and 10 experience violence, either physically being brought on them, or even witnessing violence, those children then had an erosion in the telomeres, which is part of the DNA structures in their cells, a shortening of the telomeres, which is what happens in the aging process. And the study found that the more types of violence the child witnessed, the faster the telomeres eroded, shortening their lifespan. So direct and but even observed violence affects the human body at the cellular level. And then also our body-mind is in dynamic relationship not only with other people but with the rest of the natural world. So one study a few years ago of people who live in the projects in Chicago in this one housing project, it found that the residents who were at the far end of the project next to trees and green open space, they not only had less anxiety and depression, but they had many fewer incidents of physical diseases like diabetes, asthma, intestinal problems, and back pains. So there are so many, actually, recent discoveries about the relationship between humans and nature that you may have noticed that hospitals have now redesigned their decor to have nature motifs, which costs a lot of money. So that's how established it is, only in the last 12 years with all this research. And if you've been in a hospital recently, you may have noticed the drapery often has a leaf motif. And in the patient's room, they've put a big photograph of a mountain scene. And in the corridors, they have these little water fountains, you know, with water running over stones. And sometimes in the MRI room, The last thing people see when they're being rolled in is the blue sky with white, fluffy clouds. So the reason they're doing that is because it's been very firmly established that connecting with nature, even through a photograph, helps our healing process. And I call this new field of knowledge that's emerging relational physiology. And it's different, I feel, because these discoveries, unlike the earlier ones, are so concrete and so accessible, and it's moving very quickly into mainstream areas. But what I'd like to focus on in the time remaining is just one of our organs, the brain, because it's always been held in the mechanistic view of the human body-mind, of course, that we arrive in this world with a certain capacity of mental functioning. You might be born smart or born dumb or something in between, but it's understood that you arrive with a certain kind of brain, and that's it. Now, however, that assumption is being strongly challenged by several studies that found there are numerous relational factors from infancy on through childhood that affect the development of an adult's level of intelligence. So here are five examples of what I call the relational physiology of intelligence. The first one's breastfeeding. So researchers have realized for a long time that breastfeeding is good for the physical reason that there are neurosugars in the breast milk that helps brain development. But now studies have also determined that the hours of interaction between the mother and the baby are exchanging all kinds of information through touch and language and other body language that stimulates brain development. And one study said that it controlled for lots of socioeconomic factors, but it said a baby who is breastfed for 1 year without other food being added yet gets a 6-point bounce on an IQ test, even though we know there are problems with IQ tests, but a standardized intelligence test. 6 points is what they determined. Number two, certain brain disorders. There's the example of autism. This is a new study that was just published last month by the University of California at Davis. You cannot make a definite diagnosis of autism before age 2, but as young as 6 months, certain symptoms start to show up, like rapid eye movement or unusual fixation on an object, or abnormal repetitive movements and not wanting to make eye contact. So this study identified a number of infants who were symptomatic between ages 6 months and 1 year, and it divided them into four groups. One of the groups got this therapy called Early Start, and they trained the mothers, and sometimes both parents, how to do certain motions, certain sounds, often down on the carpet with the child, certain movements every day. And by the time these babies were 3 years old, the group that had had the early start intervention had no symptoms of autism, no language delays, and no other developmental delays. So this relational interaction had affected the brain and probably the synaptic pathways. And then number three, family dynamics. Well, about 25 years ago, it was noticed by some researchers that, again, drawing on the IQ test, the firstborn child, eldest child in a family, tends to generally, score 2 or 3 points higher on the IQ test than his or her siblings. So, of course, they figured it must be something going on with the brain of the firstborn. But in 2007, a study was done in Norway of 2,041 military records of 18 and 19-year-old boys who have to go into the service. And the researchers then, looking at these records, had not only the IQ score of the test the military had given, but it also had the family history of each boy. And what they found was If the firstborn child had died early in childhood, or even if the first two children had died early and the thirdborn had been raised as the eldest, that child then scored the extra 2 or 3 points on the IQ test at age 19 that's generally seen of the firstborns. So family dynamics were affecting the development expression of intelligence. And they didn't speculate why, but, you know, parents tend to give the eldest child more responsibility, watch the kids, we're going out, and the eldest tends to identify more with the adult world and test taking. It might have something to do with that, but they didn't say. And then, number four, violation and damage to the developmental process. It's been found in many studies, cross-culturally, that whipping, spanking, beating a child lowers IQ. And the more spanking, the more it lowers the IQ. And culturally, if it's accepted and expected that all children will be whipped or spanked, you can see culturally, collectively, the scores are suppressed, even factoring in for socioeconomic factors. So the violence is apparently an anti-relational trauma to the whole system. And then last, number five, language and the relational formation of our intelligence. A researcher named Betty Hart found in the mid-1990s that children who were exposed to a lot of language in conversation before age three did much better in reading and math and intelligence tests in school than children who had heard many fewer words during that period. So there's been a lot of studies recently working off of that and developing it. And one thing they found is that if the child was hearing a lot of words in conversation, not from the mother or primary caregiver, but rather from the television set, it not only didn't have the same effect, it had a detrimental effect on their intelligence abilities later. It's clear that, before I go on, let me just say the baby Einstein device, do you remember that? Why that went by the by? When those children got to first and second grade, they had lower ability than the ones. So, what I started to say before I thought of that, you cannot substitute the organic with the technological and expect that it's not going to be damaging. And that fact is apparently very widely recognized among high-tech parents in Silicon Valley. You may have seen some of these articles in the paper where they go to these big names and say, wow, your house must be like an electronic cottage, the journalist will say. And the guy says, no, we don't let our kids go on that. And they said, really, you don't? No, they either have no televisions and computers in the house or screen time, or at a certain age, they'll let them have 1 or 2 hours a week. Or they send them even to Waldorf schools, no TV in the house. So one of the journalists asked these high-tech couples why they keep their children away from screen time, and they replied, quote, because we've seen what it does to people who were raised that way, unquote. Meanwhile, of course, their own company's marketing departments are just going full bore to convince parents all across the country that it'll benefit their child hugely to have them glued to a screen from infancy on, when, in fact, this electronic immersion is tremendously damaging to their development. So, in summary, even though it's 2014, we are just now beginning to grasp in mainstream venues that we human organisms are far, far more dynamically interrelated than modern thinking ever assumed. And of course, this deeply relational nature of reality was and is self-evident to indigenous cultures, but we hypermodern folks are pretty much at a kindergarten level of figuring out our own physical nature and how we work. It's not the way we were schooled. So one way for us to assess the effects of technology in our lives is to pay attention to whether time spent on an electronic device is significantly reducing the time and availability we need for organic relationships. But we face two difficulties in making assessments like that. First, because modern people are socialized in the mechanistic worldview, every new device seems really swell, and we're slow to see the detrimental effects. And second, because we do not yet recognize all that needs to be protected in this life, it's hard for us to make those assessments. But just keep in mind that we exist in, each of us, every moment, we're embedded in these gazillions of organic dynamic relationships. It's exhilarating. Thank you.
So we have about 10, 15 minutes for some questions. And please, given the relatively limited amount of time, we all have very strongly held views. If we could just ask questions of the panelists, that would be great. So if anybody has any questions and wants to raise their hand. Okay. Okay, so dual question for whoever would like it. One is population. Why did that not come up? And is that something someone wants to speak to? And then the second part is, why are we at environmental war with ourselves? So
just a quick response on the former, and I'll let someone else address the latter. In my parable, population did come up. I talked about the human masses and people becoming multitudes spreading across the face of the earth. So I think that was included. It's absolutely crucial.
I think it's the population question is very much connected with what I was talking about expansionism and not being able to question that. So when we look at mainstream responses to the problems that we face today, two things tend to be taken for granted, held as constant, and one is population growth, the other is economic growth. So we hear, the litany that we hear all the time is that we're heading for 10 billion people. We have to accommodate 10 billion people. We have to double food production. We have to double meat production and so on. And we're also heading toward economic growth. These things are held as sort of constant. And so we have to work around them and find the technological fixes to accommodate them. Now, it's really hard to sort of understand that kind of mindset when it's very clear that in the face of these huge problems we have, really the way to address them is to halt that expansionism, because clearly all those problems are coming from the expansionism. But somehow, that questioning can't come up in the mainstream. So it's kind of a puzzle. But the population question is also a little bit more complicated than that, in that there's been a framing of that question that makes it really hard to bring up. And I think that we need to be reframing the population issue, and pretty fast. And the one framing is that everybody thinks that it's been framed in terms of growth. So the moment you frame population in terms of growth, then everybody says, where's population growing? And it's growing in the developing world, and in particular in Africa. And all of a sudden, it looks like everybody is pointing the finger to Africa as causing all our problems, when clearly, the first world is leading in terms of causing all the problems. And that creates a huge impasse with that conversation. So I think one of the ways that we need to address that is that we don't frame population anymore in terms of growth. Let's frame it in terms of size. We have a population that is just too large. 7 billion is already too large, let alone 10. I mean, that's kind of unimaginable, right? So we need to be framing population in terms of size and not growth. And then there are other ways, in particular in relationship to food, that we need to be thinking about population, but that would take us too much far afield.
In a shameless plug, I will also note that the parable that I presented is the beginning of a forthcoming book on population called Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot, the afterword of which was written by the brilliant Eileen Crist, where she gets into the ideas of human supremacy and the population question in a very, very beautiful way. That book will be out in early 2015.
Is this working? I don't have much to add, except that, I mean, it's evident from the work that I've done that the population, the rate of population growth changed dramatically with the agricultural revolution. And so I think there is a relationship between population growth and kind of the structure of economic organization that is important to pay attention to. I mean, there's all kinds of specific reasons why population increased with agriculture, among them that we became sedentary and that increased reproductive rates. But there are other reasons as well. But anyway, I think there is that connection between economic organization, productive organization of society, and the rate of growth of population.
I think we have time for one more. Yes, right there. So to repeat the question is, how do we start to frame the destructive processes so that we can then go out and explain that to others?
Yes.
So, okay.
Well, slowness, I think, you know, I was talking about speed. Slowness is very important. I mean, a lot of people are doing meditation, which is basically a form of slowness, you know. I also think what Buber was saying, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, contemplate a tree, be present, being present. It sounds so simple, but it's hard to do in this modern day world, and yet it makes a huge difference. You know, I went and stood in my garden. I had to pick some lemons from a Meyer tree, and I went down there and something had rolled down. I went down the stairs. I was deeper into the garden. I'm standing there. And just in 2 minutes, I was transformed by just standing there. I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything. I just stood there. And you know, children talk to trees. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever taken a small child out on a walk. I mean, you know, I remember taking my grandchildren out, and they look at a flower, it's like a magnificent experience for them to try to recover that, because we're subjected to unlearning that sense of relation and wonder. And I think that's foundational to everything else we do.
Well, I agree with this. It's to focus on making a distinction of the relational, organic, dynamic, interrelated aspects as versus what's harming that. And I think we have a lot of mechanistic metaphors in our minds that we could really make an effort to weed out. And you see them expressed all the time. My daughter showed me a textbook where it was talking about a switch in the brain. Well, this gets switched off and this gets... I said, there aren't any switches in the brain. You know, when they talk about a gene being switched on or off, what they mean is this protein, the epiphenomenal, is either closing over it so it can't express or not. And that's a function of relationships. Tension and things will make it do that. So anyway, that would be one to appreciate. The organic, and also to just be aware of sometimes the way we're trained to think mechanistically. Mm-hmm. Well,
that's a huge question.
40 years of green politics.
Through Twitter.
So we've been trying to do this.
Twitter.
I'll have to talk to you later.
Tweets. That would do it.
What did he say? He said tweet.
I'm sorry.
You know what? I mean, that is the question. I think you just have to keep, we all have to keep asking that and finding answers.